All right, everybody, welcome to the first wine-induced Innovation Crush episode. My name is Chris Denson. I'm your glorious host. Is that too big? Is that too big of a word for me to use? Glorious?
No, I think it's kind
of... Okay, I'm your glorious host, Chris Denson. And in case you don't know, this show covers all things innovation, marketing, ideas, research, and insights. And today we have an amazing guest by the name of Peter McGraw. Say hello, Peter.
This is your glamorous guest.
Another G word.
Is yes. That where we...
and kind of just give us the 101 on who Peter McGraw is.
Oh, okay. So, you know, on the Twitter and stuff, you got to say like who you are. I like to say, yes. I'm a full-time scholar and part-time adventurer.
I like that handle. I like that blurb.
I like the false dichotomy. The philosophers hate it. You know, because they're like, you're just slicing up the world in a way that shouldn't be sliced. And I study what makes things funny. I'm a professor at the University of Colorado and a behavioral economist. And I founded and direct the Humor Research Lab, which we affectionately refer to as HURL.
Yes. You've got some great stories behind HURL. What is behavioral economics?
Well, yeah, so it's... I don't want to bore people with this, but like the field of economics has kind of an unreasonable set of beliefs about how human beings reason, think about the world.
Right.
And a bunch of psychologists started pointing out all those ways that humans fall short of these lofty standards. And those either economists or psychology type people have earned the moniker behavioral economist. So I don't do much economic research. I say I'm a behavioral economist because like the average person on the street has a chance to understand what that is.
I guess I'm below average.
No.
You know. You do what?
You know, like the Freakonomics crowd, yeah, totally. You know, and predictably irrational. If you read some of these things, like behavioral economics kind of jumps.
Well, it's funny because, you know, a lot of people use the word economy in an interesting way. You know, I think most people's general association is finance, right? Like, mm-hmm. And Jordan Brady, who you, I think, was featured in your book.
He was
also a guest on the show. Shout out to Jordan Brady. But, you know, I asked him what he learned from stand-up versus his career in advertising, mm-hmm. you know, what translated. And he said the economy of words. Right. It's the ability to tell a story succinctly, whether you have 30 seconds of video to sell a car mm-hmm. or you have 3 minutes on stage to make a crowd laugh, and how you use those words. So I'm interested in just sort of like, you know, that perception on economy in the behavioral sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think that so the big problem I have is I use a lot of words in my academic life.
Right.
You know, papers are 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 words. Lectures are an hour and 15 minutes.
I read the one on positive illusion, by the way, from like 2003 or something crazy. I tried to read it.
Wow.
But go ahead. Sorry. I just wanted to let you know that I've studied the scholar.
I'm impressed by that. So, you know, and then, but now I'm like out in the kind of real world. And how is it that I can take these ideas, sometimes a little bit esoteric, sometimes a little complex, and make them accessible?
Right.
You know, even just describing who I am in a way that makes sense to someone who doesn't understand this, not familiar with this world.
That's great. So the Humor Code is a book.
It is. Yes.
And what is the
There's
Humor
a lot
code?
Of them. There's a lot that are sitting on shelves.
Please get them off. Now, I read Maria earlier. She said, what is that book? And I read her the forward. And I actually saw the word quixotic in this. So yes. Speaking of the economy of words, it's great. But give us sort of the you know, what can we find inside the Humor Code? What have you uncovered in the world?
So the Humor Code is a travel log, actually. So it's not a kind of typical pop science book. It's about two men, me being one of them, and Joel Werner, a journalist, the other one, traveling the world, trying to understand this complex, mysterious thing, humor. So we have, where do we go? We go to Japan, we go to Scandinavia, we go to the Amazon, we go to the West Bank in Palestine. We came here to LA.
Yep.
New York and other places to try to blend comedy and science, you know, two ideas, two things that don't always get along. So I run experiments in Hurl. We go out and meet the characters, the people in the world who are doing comedy for a living. And we kind of probe the topic, and with the overall goal to try to understand humor. Right. What is it? What is its origins? And maybe even a little bit about how can we kind of use it a little better in our lives.
Yeah, which you told the story, speaking of like how to use it better, you told the story about using humor to basically empower people, right? You turn a negative thing into something funny, or yes, a negative incident or into something funny. Do you find that that's sort of, what's the empowering mechanism in the humor there that makes that work?
Well, yeah, I mean, so I think the thing about humor that's interesting is that it's not always empowering, right? So a lot of times it's used for evil, right? It's used to ridicule people and make people feel bad. The good side of it, although it has the same roots, can be used for good. So the idea that we explore in the humor code and is the theoretical foundation for Hurl is that humor arises from potentially dark places, from potentially negative things, what we call violations, mm-hmm, things that are threatening or wrong or amiss. But of course, the things in the world that are threatening, wrong, or amiss, they don't normally make us laugh. They make us cry. They make us cringe. They make us angry. You know, they create negative emotions. There has to be something else there. And that's the idea that the situation's okay, acceptable, or as we say, benign. And it's these benign violations, these situations that are wrong yet okay, are the ones that we laugh at, we delight in, and we say, hey, that's funny. Well, if you think about it, that's really in some ways a coping mechanism.
Right.
The things that are the tough day in traffic, mm-hmm, can be a source of frustration or anger, or it could be a source of comedy. And so taking the thing that's wrong, the bad traffic, transforming it into something that's less wrong.
Isn't there a breaking point? Like sometimes when you talk about like when I have a bad day, right? The whole traffic incident, and let's say, you know, the fourth bad thing has happened, right? Your hot dog has just fallen on your shirt. I don't know where I got that example. That's from
eating the hot dogs, the coping mechanism.
Hot dogs are hilarious.
that was me trying to cope. But then like there comes this point where I go, like the last thing happens and I just start cracking up. Uh-huh. Right. I go, yeah, it's like, right, it's like I've let go, or, you know, it's just like it all of a sudden has become a funny day.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation. By the way, sometimes a hot dog is just a hot dog.
That's true.
Right. I think Freud said something like that. Right? No,
it's not Freudian. Trust me. The buns, maybe.
I think. What you're observing, so to my knowledge, no one's ever done the research on this, but I think this has this
notion. I just wrote your next book.
It's a very nice idea.
The humor breaking point.
it is a notion of absurdity, right? So why is it that we laugh at things and we say that's absurd? So I had this experience. So I work at a university. I'm at the University of Colorado, and a bureaucratic place. A well-intentioned administrator, secretary, assistant, administrative assistant, created a full-page color-coded flowchart to help you decide how to go about having alcohol at your university function.
Or on your podcast.
It was, well, yeah. I mean, that's just, do you want it? Yes or no?
Right.
And then if yes, you have it. But I mean, it was, I got this thing. I opened it up as a PDF. I was in my office late at night and I just started cracking up laughing, and I couldn't understand. I was like, why am I laughing at this thing in the same way? I think the same process applies to what you just described, the hot dog incident. It's just like, you're like, this is so bad. Like this can't be real.
Right.
Like this is so out of bounds that you sort of spontaneously code it as not real.
Yeah.
Like you're now out of this world. It's a situation where you just can't believe that
you've
this
suspended
is happening
the belief for a second.
Yeah. And what happens, what that does, though, is that provides distance in a way that helps make these violations benign. So bear with me for a second.
I'm doing it.
Okay. So if you think about comedic television.
Yes.
Okay, let's say cable network, whatever it may be. What comedy shows feature the biggest violations? Like, have like the worst, the most heinous things happening
right
on them? It's the cartoons. It's the Family Guy. It's South Park. And how is it that they can get away with having just this horrible? I mean, South Park murders a child at the end of every episode.
Right.
Which the only reason you can get away with that is that these are made up children. Right. They're totally hypothetical. No one's really being harmed in the making of this show.
Right.
And Kenny, the murdered child, is the least human of all the children. Like, he barely even seems like a person in many ways. Right. So they create such distance that it allows them to kind of pull this stuff off. But I think that, like, absurdity, this description of like, it can't get any worse, you're just like, this can't be really happening to me, helps with create this sort of spontaneous sense of distance.
Yeah.
That's necessary to take these bad things and make them okay.
Yeah, because it's interesting, you know, when you go back, like, if you tell the story of that bad day a few days later, it is funny, right? And, you know, it's almost like a Vacation. You know, it's like every bad thing possible has happened to Clark Griswold and yes. his family, including the apex of the movie, which is they got to Wally World and it was close.
It's close. That's right.
Which to me is like the funniest joke of all time.
They're doing a remake of that. No,
I hope not.
Something it's, about that. Some modern day.
It's going to be tough to pull off. Like, it's such, like, I don't know. There's certain things you leave alone. That's my opinion. And no offense to whoever's making that movie. I would love to have you as a guest on the show. Why has this become your passion, your work? Because, you know, when I read your title, you're a professor of marketing.
Yes.
As well as, you know, the behavioral psychology.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, why has this piece of your interest taken off so much? Why did this become the passion point for Peter?
Well, you know, so some of it I actually have to attribute it to my training as a marketing professor. So what happened was I stumbled on this question about 6.5 years ago. And I mean, it's a really compelling question, right? Like, so what makes things funny? Like, if you can accomplish one thing in the world, answering that question would be a pretty cool
right.
thing to do. So I had read around the same time, I had been kind of just considering, like, where am I taking my career? I was sort of heading towards tenure. After tenure, you know, you're kind of in this sort of flat spot, like where you can do a lot of things. You have a lot more
do whatever
freedom.
I want to do right
That's
now.
Right. You just start flipping off
Peter,
colleagues.
You coming in today? Maybe.
That's a little more true than you might think, actually. But I had just read this book, Blue Ocean Strategy. And Blue Ocean Strategy, the book really made a big impression on me. The authors of the book make a case for either positioning your product or creating a market or identifying a market that is just, as they say, blue ocean, largely untapped. There's almost right. no competition there. And so as I was pondering this perplexing question and thinking about it, I also realized that studying humor not only was important, but also in some ways would be easier than a lot of the other stuff that I was studying because no one in my field was looking at it.
Right.
And
what were people looking at? Like, what?
They were looking at things like regret and pride and embarrassment okay. and all. They were looking at other compelling emotional experiences, but for some reason, humor had been overlooked, despite the fact that it's an age-old question. It goes back 2,500 years. So sure. Plato and Aristotle tried to answer it. And I was like, oh, we should do this. This is important. And you have a chance to kind of make a big splash. And I mean, studying comedy is a lot more enjoyable than studying regret, for
yes.
instance.
Yeah. I mean, you don't regret it.
Not at all. I mean, I marvel at how... So like 6.5 years is a long time, but in academic time, it's nothing.
Right.
It's, you know, it's a small period of time to be studying something. How much my life is now different as a result of it.
Now, have you tied the two together, right? Like a understanding humor, but also coming from a marketing angle and this idea of a blue ocean and finding a market, you know, where did the two blend? Like, you know, a funny commercial or a funny tweet or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, some form of, humoristic engagement, if you will. You like that one?
Yeah.
I see. Now I don't know what's funny. no, but like, how did you, have you tied the two together yet?
Yeah. So we have in the lab, in terms of our academic work, we're trying to publish sort of basic psychology articles, but we're also publishing in marketing. So there has been some work on humor and advertising, and it's not terribly, the results won't be surprising to someone like you, right? So it's like humor helps you cut through the clutter. It's more likely to be shared with other people. People have a bit better memory for it. Largely, the beliefs about it are positive. There's a little bit of work that shows how it can backfire on you. So for instance, like if you use unrelated humor attempts, it may distract from your main message. And so the best humorous marketing communications weave the message along with the comedy in a way, right, that it's seamless, rather than just tacking on something funny just to get people to pay attention, because they remember the funny thing, but they don't remember the brand.
Well, I feel like that's also like the problem, right? You remember, you know, most things, you remember the funny moment, but not the product.
Yes.
Or not the service.
Yeah, you remember the celebrity, but not necessarily the brand, right? Like, this is a constant problem in terms of getting people to pay attention, but then also like, getting them to understand the message that you're trying.
Has anyone done it well? Like, if you, I mean, not to put you on the spot and like draw something up really quick,
yes,
but no, has one, you just kicked me under the table.
Oh, sorry.
I like it. No, but yeah. Is there an example that you can think of that has done it well or poorly for that matter?
Yeah. So I'll tell you the case study that I think is most interesting. So, imagine a world like a world of three different types of brands. There's sort of the funny brand. It's a small world, right? Like Southwest Airlines sort of has that kind of funny brand. Geico sort of has that kind of funny brand, where a lot of their messaging is humor based. And it even goes, it even pervades the company in the case of Southwest, like, you know, funny flight attendants and things like
right.
that. Then you have your very serious brands, right? The Schwabs of the world, and this is a very serious thing, and we're going to do our best to. And there's very little comedy associated with right. those brands. What I'm interested in are the brands that lie in between those two. That is, they're a serious brand, but they use humor sort of tactically,
right?
And I think Nike is one of those brands. And so it's not obvious, right? So if you say, right. is Nike a funny brand?
Yeah, that's what I just said in my mind.
Yeah. And you say, no, they're not a funny brand. But actually, they're sort of like your friend who's typically pretty serious, but occasionally is hilarious. You catch him at the right moment. And Nike's a lot like that. So if you watch their marketing communications, you always get the same message from them, which is, we're at the leading edge of technology, and that technology is going to let you be the best athlete that you can be.
Right.
And what they do is they find funny situations at times to demonstrate that particular message. So back in the day, they have you can find this on YouTube. They have a very funny commercial. It's this pretty blonde woman. She's in her running gear, and she's in some cabin, and she's like standing in front of the sink, like washing up.
Yeah.
She's wearing her Nike sneakers. And she like closes the mirror, and there's a Jason character in the mirror, and she like screams and starts to run away. And here's a Jason character. He has a chainsaw. He's sort of lumbering after her.
Right.
And you're heading down that path. We've all seen it in the horror films where the pretty blonde woman is running away, and then she stumbles and falls, and then
right.
you know, carnage ensues. But not this woman.
Right.
Because she's wearing her Nike running shoes, and she trains hard. And
that's awesome.
And you can see where this is going. She just basically sprints into the darkness, and the Jason character's lumbering along and falls out of breath and,
right.
and gets away. And it says, you know, the tagline is like, Nike, stay alive. And it's a very funny scene. It's very memorable, enjoyable. But what it does is it says, if you use our gear, you are going to be the best athlete that you can be.
Right.
And I think that's a really nice
And you will
example.
Not die.
Exactly. Yeah. Is there any stronger a message that you could end up having? Well, this happens over and over again. There's a recent commercial with Rooney, the
Mickey Rooney?
No, the what's his soccer, the UK British soccer. No, sorry,
kidding, yes. Yeah.
But it has like this counterfactual flashback where he doesn't perform well, and then you see him in his mobile home with his big beer belly and beard and so on. Like you see this world of
right,
and it's an amusing world to imagine this soccer star in, and then he ends up actually performing really quite well and winning the game and
yeah,
accolades and all this kind of stuff.
Well, do you find like, okay, so you look at a big global brand like Nike and you've kind of traveled the world under, you know, the guise of studying humor and why it works.
So, the scam.
Exactly.
The scheme.
Under this false pretense that you were writing. You had the book done already. Is there, you know, because you have to take into consideration obviously cultural points of references, mm-hmm, you know, sometimes when you like, oh, you watch, you Google funniest commercial on YouTube, mm-hmm, you're going to get some French commercial or right, Czechoslovakian, you know, like, and I'm like, or it's weird and it's racy and it's like, I haven't seen it before. It's kind of funny, but so how much does culture play into just humor in general and or how a brand might interact? Like that Nike commercial might be very different in, you know, Zimbabwe.
Yeah, or Brazil or something. Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I think it's paramount. I don't think that you can pursue comedy as a brand and ignore culture. And the reason is that if you agree with me that humor arises from seeing a situation as wrong yet okay, well, what's wrong and what's okay depends on the individual who's doing the perceiving. And cultures determine what's wrong and what's okay. And so as a result, if you want to try to make someone laugh, you have to understand their perspective on the world. And so brands that ignore that perspective, whether it be in their marketing communications or in their product innovation or in their supply chain or however it is they're going about doing it, are going to run into problems. And so one of the things that we've been doing in Hurl is actually looking at the downsides of trying to pursue comedy.
Right.
So I think that in general, people, brands in particular, believe is that humor is good and that it should be pursued sometimes for its own sake. Certainly the ad agencies want to pursue it because they're filled with creative people who really,
yeah,
it's more fun to work on a funny commercial than it is to work on a serious commercial. So they're always selling it. They're always pushing it. But the issue is that for instance, when you fail to be funny, you can fail in one of two ways. You can bore the audience. That is that you create a situation where there's no violation. There's nothing wrong about that situation. Right. So I like to say that's like tickling yourself.
Which I do nightly.
Yes, and unless you're special. Well,
you did a rat tickling experiment, or did you look at a rat tickling experiment?
Yes, there's research on rat tickling. That's right. And so these researchers tickle rats. They sort of roughhouse these rats.
Yes.
And these rats make this sort of chirping sound that is akin to laughter. And it fits that idea, right?
Right.
This is like a harmless attack.
And they're also more delicious after they've laughed.
After you've tenderized them. but the other thing is that, like, that's fine. Like, it's fine to tell a joke that sort of falls flat, you know, that's okay. But the opposite of having a joke that's too tame is to have a joke that's too risque. That is a joke that there's nothing benign about it. It's just violation.
Right.
That's like akin to on your way home tonight, some creepy guy in a trench coat tickling you.
Yes.
Right. Like right. That's funny. That's funny to think about.
Yeah,
right.
But
now,
it's not funny to actually.
It wouldn't
go
be
through.
Funny in the moment. So when brands pursue comedy, when they fail, they can fail in one of two ways. And one of those ways is that you offend an audience and you don't really want to be offending your target market. So you have to really understand your target market and what they find funny. You
right.
can't just rely on what your ad agency says is going to be funny because those folks, you know, they're hard to offend.
Right.
But your customer may be easy to offend.
But there's, you know, it's interesting because I feel like, you know, I started my career doing it like at age 17. I did stand up for probably 8 years.
I'm there. Sorry to hear that.
That's fine. No, so was the audience.
It's a tough thing. It's tough.
No, it was my thing was I didn't want to go on the road as a starving comedian.
Were you living here?
No, I started in Detroit, okay. Michigan State University. But no, it's like this, you know, there's this journey of just being in the moment funny,
mm-hmm.
and then belaboring a, you know, a funny moment. So I think what sometimes might happen in the agency world is that, you know, Joe has written the script. It's hilarious. Everybody laughed in the room. Mm-hmm. 2 days go by. I was like, well, what about this line about the, you know, the grass? I'm like, well, no, it's the grass. And so you, yes, writing is rewriting, but I think a lot of things die on the vine, perhaps. I'm speculating, because they become belabored when I walk into James, the executive, or Sue, the executive, and she goes, oh, this, you know, and then it's write it all over again. And over the course of a month of developing this thing, the energy is lost behind it.
I see, yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, just in general, like, well, the moment versus long-term creating funny.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, I'm not sure that getting notes on your jokes for a commercial is the best way to create good comedy. You know, I mean, really, like, unless the key is to just play it really, really safe.
Right.
And in that way, then it's probably a useful thing. I mean, the challenge is that you can even get laughs and hurt yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So let's just use this situation. You're out with friends and your friend lets off a big fart. Right.
Yes.
You start laughing. Hilarious. You're like, that guy is really funny. And then you go,
that guy is funny.
You're like, that guy is funny. And you go like that. But there's also something wrong with him. Right. Like, you know, so what happens is there's the attributions. So it's not just the laugh that you're pursuing. It's like you want to have a message that's consistent with your brand.
Right.
You want to have the right tone of like, well, what kind, you know, like if this were a person, what kind of person would it be? And then even still, like, some of the work we've done in Hurl has shown that like, for instance, there's all these humorous PSAs now, these public service announcements.
Right.
Okay. Well, the reason they're pursuing humor is because humor cuts through the clutter. People pay attention to it. Problem is, if you want to try to tell someone that there's a problem is a problem, and you do it by making jokes about it, you're sort of telling the audience
that's not that serious.
It's not that serious. And so as a result, so it's like, it's just a tough situation, right? Because now you're trying to get the maximum laugh. You're trying to create the right marketing message that says what you want to say about your particular product, the argument you're making in your marketing communications, and then also that you're portraying the brand in a way that's consistent with
the
way. Well,
that's the thing. I think even in your own demographic, you can't please everybody, right? Like,
no.
Even though Nike knows that runner, or, you know, what's it? Copa knows that wine drinker from the little plastic cup that I told you I was doing something classy for you. But no, it's like you know
this is only 12.7% alcohol.
I'm sorry. That's, isn't that high?
I think that's low, isn't it?
I don't know what wine. What is wine?
14? We want 14, right?
Wine's normally like 13.
13.
Oh, 12.7.
All right, we'll round it up. That was your producer, though, by the way. Just so.
Yes. People know Maria better. You can see her hair, though. It looks
She's like, I'm never going to see that 14 guy again, so I'm going to go with 13.
No, but just kind of knowing, like, you can't please everyone, right? It's the same way, like, I can watch a...
That's, I hate to say this, that's a Bill Cosby quote. Is to try to please everyone.
No.
Is to please no one or something like that.
Yes,
you know, we're not. Well, let's not digress.
You're talking about the Bill Cosby that we all knew and loved.
The former
Pudding Pops.
Yes.
I think, and that's what, and that's with anything, even if, you know, things that aren't humor. You kind of. You put it out there, people are going to gravitate toward it. It's the same way, because one of the things I was wondering about just from a psychological standpoint is, you know, debating what's funny, right?
Mm-hmm.
Me and one of my best friends, we are probably the silliest duo you'll ever see in life. Like, we'll joke for days and we'll never get back on a topic and meander and create scenarios and so on and so forth. But on sometimes we'll go like, hey, you see this thing? It was hilarious. And he's like, that's not funny.
Mm.
So what distinguishes those, you know, that what's the mechanism there? So
I actually like to say that you can never say that's not funny. you have to say that's not funny to me, because it is actually the case that the same very same humor attempt can elicit three different reactions. One person could be cracking up laughing, another person terribly offended, and then the third saying, dude, that's so boring. Like, what are you talking about? And so, but again, it just depends. And these people can be from the same culture. It's not just culture that determines what you see as wrong or okay, what you determine to be a benign violation, but it has to do with your own personal belief system, your experiences, your mood, for instance. Right. And so in that way, like, it's just, there's so much risk and reward that goes along with pursuing this. Now, I don't want us to just talk about advertising.
Sure.
Because so this blue ocean idea has pushed the folks in Hurl to think about humor and marketing outside of marketing communications. So, for instance, we have a paper that's coming out on humorous complaining. So if you think about it, really, so Lorne Michaels has this quote that says that comedy is complaining done with charm. That really fundamentally what stand-up comics do, my suspicion is what you did as a stand-up comic, was you pointed out what's wrong with the world in some way, shape, or form. Sure. Maybe it was what was wrong with you. Maybe it was what was wrong with your family, what was wrong with the government, whatever it may be. And you do it in a way that's really entertaining. Well, this idea of humorous complaining is actually a really important one within marketing, because you have customers. They complain. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they complain to you, the brand. Sometimes they complain to each other, you know, over yep. dinner. Sometimes they put it on Yelp, on Amazon, and so on. Well, a humorous complaint may help them cope. I believe that's the case. But it also, because it's attention getting, because it's memorable, because it's more likely to be shared, when your customers are complaining humorously, making jokes about their bad experience, they're more likely to have an effect on you.
Right.
Right. People are more likely to pay attention to it. And so it's much more likely to become, I won't say viral, but it's more likely to become a kind of popular.
Well, it's interesting.
Thing.
It's kind of like, you know, I've been lately kind of fascinated with companies' abilities to turn negative, you know, things into positive things. One, for example, was, you know, an A-frame chalkboard outside of a sandwich shop. And it said, come on in and try the worst sandwich a guy on Yelp ever had in his life. and I wanted to go in and try the sandwich. Yeah, so, you know, right. It was
because you like them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We like funny people.
Exactly. You're like, OK, yeah. Cool. And they got the joke, that's whatever, you know, and or you look at
that's you know, in some ways, that's a humorous complaint. Right? Right. They're expressing their dissatisfaction with this joker on Yelp in a way that makes you like them.
Right.
Yeah. We like humorous complainers more than serious.
It's very true. Or, you know, I think every year YouTube does this video series where people walk into the YouTube help desk and they're like, usually like YouTube influencers, you know, and you've seen.
Okay.
And they're complaining about like common things that happen on YouTube. Like, oh, my file won't upload. And then, you know, the person will like fade in and out of the thing or somebody else will walk in and like, oh, you're here for the comedy thing. I love your clown makeup. And you're like, this is my real makeup. I have a, you know, a makeup advice channel. So they've got all these things that you hear about YouTubers. I came from a big YouTube network professionally. And so like that idea of taking the complaint and turning it on.
Yeah, and making it more enjoyable and so on. So it's like, and then there's the whole world. I'll tell you this, there's been no research, and this is where I want to head, on how to make things funnier. Right? So we're always looking at the consequence, you know, so we look at the antecedents. So what is it that helps make something funny? And if something is funny or not, what are the consequences? But can you use those insights to actually create funnier people, funnier ads, funnier TV shows, funnier YouTube videos,
right.
Whatever it may be? Like that is just, you want to talk about blue ocean.
Yeah.
No, I hope none of my academic peers are going to hear this because they're like, oh my God, there's a great idea.
No,
but you know what I mean? Like, so if you think about it, like, so you were stand up. How'd yes. you get funnier? I'm sure you got funnier in there 7 or 8 years.
I would hope so.
How, but what was like,
It was just like the repetition, trying different iterations of things, growing as a person, right? I think stand-up is really a real stand-up is about connecting your experience to an audience. It was just a growth pattern, but a lot of it was the repetition and refining of the interesting thing about belaboring humor. Right. And we were talking about this earlier where, you go see a stand up do a show and you see him two or three times in the same night. It's verbatim inflection, word choice, the falling on the stage or whatever the thing that felt very natural was 100% rehearsed and planned and thought out. You know, it's like actors. You know, you look at Christian Bale, who's a method actor and, you know, had his whole thing about blowing up at the director in his Terminator, I think it was. And he went all berserk and like yelled, oh, man, you got to look it up. But it was...
He was in character.
Even those things are calculated, right?
Yeah.
Every decision, the look, the raise of an eyebrow, this is decision process. That.
Yeah, so you're learning to become a performer. You're learning what works and so on. What I want to know is how can science supplement that, right? So what are the kinds of insights that you can provide someone that might cut that learning curve, right? So there's always like the 10-year... To be a comic, you got to get your voice. You need your 10 years on stage and all that stuff. Well, what if there was a way to do it in less than that using science?
Right.
That's an exciting idea.
It's wearable technology.
Heart rates. But I mean, I think there are those kinds of things, right? Like comics, they have great intuition, but they don't have theory. Imagine you gave them theory.
Right.
Like imagine even just something like as simple as, you start by looking for something that's wrong or amiss, right? Like if you just believe in a benign violation account, if I've converted anyone, will that help the writing process? For instance, like you'll head down a path much quicker than you would have otherwise.
It's kind of like if you know the principles of a theory, you can get to the end result quicker.
Yes, I agree.
It's the same way where, you know, the first scripts I wrote were absolutely horrible. Not content-wise, format-wise. And so I sent out, like 100 different, packets of sketch comedy that I had written between the ages of 19 and 21 or whatever.
Okay.
There was one guy who's like, came back and goes, your stuff is funny, but you should go down Hollywood Boulevard and grab a script so you can do the format. Because nobody would look at the thing.
Yeah, because it didn't seem professional. Right, but
the mechanics of the funny, though, I think could be the same way. Like you said, what are the scenarios that we tend to, that we can play with that are funny or that are funny.
So I don't want to ruin it. I just had coffee with a comedian friend here in town.
Were you getting coffee?
I'm going to ruin.
Or in the car?
No. That would have been nice. She's much less famous than Seinfeld. I'm going to ruin one of her tweets. She hasn't tweeted it yet, but I'm sure she will by the time this
goes.
Someone asked if we could watch her things while she went outside and make a phone call. And, so this woman's tweet, she's composed and she's a writer, right? She's a comedian. So she's always writing. She's like, I'd like to see the look on people's face when I say no, to that request.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's very funny. Like you can imagine creating a joke around the idea of people asking you to do things that no one ever says no to.
Right.
And yet you say no, in part because it's your prerogative to say no. And so the idea is that she, in great instincts, has the ability to notice like how to create a moment of tension in a way that's okay to create a moment of tension, right? Like, so when someone says, oh, do you mind watching my things? And you say, yes, I do. I don't actually want to do that.
Right.
That's wrong, but it's...
It's your option.
It's your option, right? Like, in that kind of way. And so, like, now what if you can give people that task as a way to go about starting to identify useful topics, right? So even you think about, let's go back to the Nike situation. Mm-hmm. If you take a common sort of trope, is that the right word?
Use trope sounds word? Fine. I
think that's right. Do you have a fact checker?
Maria?
Trope? Okay.
The trope is a word.
The trope of like the pretty blonde woman who falls down, you know, so that kind of thing. And you're like, okay.
Damsel in distress.
Yes. How is it that we can make her succeed? Right? You know, you take, and how do you flip that idea? And so I think that comedy writers have good instincts and good things, but is there a way to formalize it in a sense that can sort of speed along the process? Maybe you get better ideas, more ideas, et cetera.
That's awesome. Yeah. And then we have a few more minutes. You tell this story, and this I love the context of the story, or you told me the story. I'm going to see if it's true. But you were hanging out with Mike Epps. Yes. And you had a Guinness, and then somehow fried chicken entered the conversation.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And so you dissected the reason why fried chicken is A, offensive, and still funny at the same time.
Right. So Mike's doing work on racial humor. He's like, he has a project that's trying to understand, like, when is racial humor funny and when is it not, and all these kinds of things. And so we were talking about fried chicken jokes and why they are funny, why they are offensive, and all this kind of thing. And so I did a little digging and figured out what is racist about fried chicken jokes. And so bear with me as we
no, let's go.
It's really, I mean, it's I was great. Fascinated by this.
I was fascinated when you told me.
Okay. Yeah. So the issue is that a fried chicken joke is a put down joke. So it's designed to take a group of people, black people, and say, you're lower class. And first of all, there's a history all the way back to slavery about jokes about slaves stealing chickens and getting caught for it. So some of this is like this, you know, like this is just demonstrate how desperate right. these folks were.
Hilarious,
but over time,
no.
I know.
No, okay.
I mean, they're and the jokes aren't terribly funny anymore. Right. But if you're a white racist,
sure,
white racist. If you're a racist,
especially a white racist,
among the white racists, those are hilarious jokes, right? So, but what happened is over time, so fried chicken is really popular in the black community, has been for a long time. But there's a hierarchy of meats that exists. So anthropologists have studied meat, and they put meat on these like a ranking system. So it's not just the meat, but also how it's prepared. And fried chicken falls very low on the hierarchy. And the reason is this is like it's like beef in the United States. Beef is the
right
is like the highest
it's
form
what's
of
for
meat.
Dinner
exactly it's like you know it's like beef pork chicken
pork comes before chicken
I think so
well, we'll have to, yeah
I'm pretty sure it does
right
and then also the method of preparation is also part of the ranking system so roast beef mm-hmm. is higher than frying. And so to make jokes about why black people like fried chicken so much is basically to say, oh, they're low class because they like this lower form of meat.
Right.
And also form of cooking it. Like, I mean, really what it comes down to is like proper people don't eat with their hands.
Yes.
They don't lick their fingers.
Yes, because you were saying that too. So it's like it's also the way it is consumed.
The way it's consumed is another form of
right.
Of the, yeah, and so then like so roast beef, you cut it with a knife and you eat it with a fork and so on. Fried chicken, you just
pick it up and
you just. I mean, I bite into
the juicy goodness.
I love fried chicken. I never thought that I was devaluing myself by eating it.
Well, it's like one of my favorite reference jokes is Dave Chappelle when he's like he was going through all the racial beats, you know, of Asians can't drive and so on and so forth. And he's like, and black people love fried chicken and watermelon. He's like, if you don't love fried chicken and watermelon, there's something wrong with you. Like it's delicious, you know.
And yeah, I mean, it's totally. And you know, if you think about it, like if you're a poor family, that's. You know, it's meat that's accessible, and then it's, you know, it's like it's tasty, and you know, I mean, look, I remember in my neighborhood, like people would reuse the grease,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
You know what I mean, that yep. kind of thing, and so it was easy to do.
So speaking of food that's bad for you,
mm-hmm.
you know, you look at a brand like a McDonald's mm-hmm. or, you know, any sort of fast food organization or something that you just know is bad for you. Red Bull.
Right? Alcohol.
We all know Red. And you see these funny commercials. You see these things. You have an affinity for them based on messaging you've mm-hmm. received. But at the same time, you know it could kill you, or it has killed people.
Wait, Red Bulls kill people?
I don't know. I'm making it up. but
my students have tried to kill themselves on Red Bull preparing for my on final exams. Or,
oh, yes.
Yeah.
You drive them
over
hard,
huh? ODing.
But no, we know these rules of okay. consequence and how we engage with things. Mm-hmm. Like, what goes into the decision-making process when I'm hungry mm-hmm. and, you know, I've encountered X number of Burger King messages.
Right.
And I decided to make that decision anyway. We won't have a chance to get to it, but I also noticed that you have the moral lab.
Yeah. Right? You've done your homework.
Yeah.
Kind of impressed by this.
Thank you. But I wanted to get into that because there is a certain sense of morality that goes into what we all know about certain fast food groups or mm-hmm. just anything where, you know, Exxon and oil.
Yes.
And we have the right to choose whether we support pink slime at McDonald's.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah.
But Big Mac is delicious
yes.
at the end of the day. Like, they're going to get my $3.
Yeah, the really tough thing, I mean, what you've really identified is that so none of the things that you just mentioned will kill you in the moment, right? You know, so these are, so any one cigarette or any one Big Mac
Crack rock.
Is actually really, well, maybe. it's not doing that much damage, right? It's the culmination of many cigarettes and many, many Big Macs that end up taking its toll. And so what ends up happening is like all these risks are very distant and we're much more focused on the present. And especially when it comes to things that are delicious and provide us a high and all these kinds of things that we have a tendency to discount the future. So very simply is if you offer the average person, do you want a dollar now or $2 a month from now? They'll take the dollar now.
Right.
And yet the $2 a month from now is a much better value in the same way that like living a long life is a much better value than probably having that
right
cigarette or that Big Mac in the moment. And so you already have that working against you as a human. That most people tend to discount the future. They feel very detached from that future person who will do the suffering. And then on top of it, now you have this association that, you know, you have these childhood associations with McDonald's of like, that's a fun place. I like McDonald's. I got to play there. We had birthday parties there. You have an affinity
right
towards this thing. Or you think like, oh, this, I'm the cool guy, right? You know, drinking this or smoking that or whatever it may be. And so those two things come together, to create a habit that is tough to kick and that eventually you end up regretting.
That's great. Yeah. The show is called Innovation Crush.
It is.
Yes. I didn't know if you knew where you showed up to. Thank you for the book, by the way. I can't wait to look at it. Can I read the inscription? What did you write on there?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It says, Chris, may most of your violations be benign. That's awesome. That's great. So what are you crushing on in the world that is, you know, that you consider innovative? It doesn't have to be in your field. It can be, you know, somewhere else out there, or it may be in the world you play in.
Yeah. So I think that I've already alluded to it. So we're headed... So for 6.5 years, we've been studying what makes things funny. The next 6.5, let's say, mm-hmm. is going to be how to make the world a funnier place. So we're writing some grants and we're putting together some studies where we're going to essentially pit the state of the art, which is, you know, the world of comedy, against the state of the art in the world of science,
right.
and create a horse race to see which of the two can make funnier people.
Your work is interesting, right? And it's very intriguing.
Yes, it's incredibly interesting.
It's very poignant. It's entertaining. through your lens, why is it important?
Well, so some of it is that people pursue this they pursue this in their consumption lives. So they, you know, they go to movies, they watch sitcoms, they spend countless hours, you know, on Reddit and YouTube surfing and finding funny material. They also pursue it in their personal lives. They're friends, right? So, you know, you talked about a friend who you're very clearly close with him, and you have a chance to hang out with him when you can because he brings you such joy. You bring him such joy. We look for this in our partners, you know, in our dating life and the people we marry and so on. And then I think then it starts to get kind of really deep in the sense that that surrounding yourself with funny people, finding a way to create a bit of comedy out of the tragedy that comes, the natural part of being human, the bad things that happen, having that kind of orientation, understanding humor may actually help us better cope with a tough world, you know, a world with pain, stress, and adversity. And so, you know, if you can find humor in a concentration camp, in a POW camp, which anthropologists, historians have done it, you know that this is something.
Hogan's Heroes.
Something that, yeah, has persisted, that can persist in even the darkest times. If there's some way that we can better understand it and perhaps even enhance it, perhaps we can make the world a little better.
That's awesome. Place. Last but not least, finish this phrase for me.
Okay.
You getting tired of this? I like that you laugh randomly. Because it's like the humor guy is just like random laughter. Innovation to me is...
Oh, wow. All right. I have to tell you, I live in Boulder, Colorado, which has become a bit of a innovation hub.
Yeah.
And I've really been just as living there and having friends in the tech community and so on I will answer your question, but, sure. But it's gotten to me to a point where I've been trying to apply these principles, this notion of disruption and trying to find new ways, novel ways to solve problems. I've been trying to apply it to academia. And so I always think of the innovation process as a problem solving process, really. So like at its core, innovation to me is solving important problems.
That's great.
That's my answer.
Thank you. And it is a fine answer. Fine in the sense that it's better than great. That is a fine answer, sir. Great answer. See the difference. So how can people find you? What are your tweet handles? What are websites? All that good stuff.
Okay. Let's see. So I'm on the Twitter at Peter McGraw, and I have a website, petermcgraw.org. Some real estate agent in like Oklahoma or something has .com.
There's also a Chris Denson real estate agent in Atlanta, and he had all the credit. Now there's a basketball college student
that's
like
too
a
bad.
Star. And like,
and then you can go to humorcode.com, and the book, you can find it anywhere. You can even get it used on Amazon. I wouldn't mind. I just want people to read it. I don't care about making money.
Simon & Schuster. All right.
Ah, the producer just shook her head in a way that seemed impressed.
Well, yes, she just does that.
She yawned earlier at one point.
She's been doodling.
I was talking, though, when she yawned.
Oh, good. All right. Yes. She's behind my back, so I'm like, I had to turn around. And, what are you doing? But thank you so much. This has been great. Everyone else, thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.